10th, 2015, in Melbourne, Australia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, Further Inquiries by Vidura, Text 6. Bhagavan Eka Evaisha Sarvakshetre Svavastita Amusya Durbhaga Amusya Durbhaga Twamva Kleshava Karma Bhikutha. Please chant. Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ekaha, alone. Eva Eshaha, all these. Sarva, all. Kshetreshu, in the living entities. Avastitaha, situated. Amusya, of the living entities. Durbhagatvam, misfortune. Va, either. Kleshaha, miseries. Va, or. Karmabihi, activities. Kutaha, what for? Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord as the Super Soul is situated in every living being's heart. Why then do the living entity's activities result in misfortune and misery? Have you ever asked that question? Purport. The next question put forward by Vidura to Maitreya is, why are the living entities subjected to so many miseries and misfortune in spite of the Lord's presence in their heart as a Super Soul? The body is considered a fruitful tree, and the living entity and the Lord as Super Soul are like two birds seated in that tree. The individual soul is eating the fruit of the tree, but the Super Soul, the Lord, is witnessing the activities of the other bird. A citizen of the state may be in miseries for want of sufficient supervision by the state authority. But how can it be possible that a citizen suffers from other citizens while the chief of the state is personally present? Everybody follow that logic? So if there's a bad government for want of sufficient supervision by the state authorities, if the state authorities aren't taking proper care, so the citizens might be in misery. This happens all over the world, right? Some governments are better than others, but there's no government that has perfect supervision, and so sometimes the citizens suffer because the government isn't on top of things. But how can it be possible that a citizen suffers from other citizens while the chief of the state is personally present? So if the president or the prime minister was in the room, how could one citizen hurt another citizen in the presence of the chief of the state? From another point of view, it is understood, okay, so that's from the point of view of God. Point of view that God's the authority, he's in the heart, he's right there in the heart. So because he's right there in the heart, how is it possible that the living entities are having misfortune when he's right there? Okay, from another point of view, it is understood that the jiva living entity is qualitatively one with the Lord, and thus his knowledge in the pure state of life cannot be covered by nescience, especially in the presence of the Supreme Lord. So from another perspective, the jiva has the same qualities of God. So how can the jiva be in ignorance when the jiva is sitting right next to God? How then does a living entity become subjected to ignorance and covered by the influence of maya? The Lord is the father and protector of every living entity, and he is known as the Bhuta Brit, or the maintainer of the living entities. So you might say, well, maybe God's just not very nice. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe he's just kind of nasty. So here Prabhupada's saying, no, he's the father, he's the protector, he's the maintainer. Why then should the living entity be subjected to so many sufferings and misfortunes? It should not be so. But actually we see that it happens everywhere. This question is therefore put forward by Vidura for a solution. Bhagavan eka evaisha sarvakshetre svavastita amusya dur bhagatvam va klesho va karma bhi kuta. So durba, not bhagya, but durbhagya, misfortune and klesha, suffering from the karma, from the activities of the living entity, even though Bhagavan is sarvakshetreshu avastita, he's everywhere. So the Lord is a super soul situated in every living being's heart. Why then do the living entity's activities result in misfortune and misery? So we have a little bit of a problem with today's class because this verse only gives the question, it doesn't give the answer. And the purport only gives the question, it doesn't give the answer. Because this is a chapter of further inquiries by Vidura. It's just a bunch of questions. It's not any answers. So I think we could just in this class say, we don't know the answer. This is just the question. And you could wait for further chapters for the answer. Should we do that? Should we just get more into the question, or should we also look at the answer? Because Prabhupada doesn't give the answer in this purport. The answer is not given in the verse, and the answer is not given in the purport. Simply the question is raised. So we could say that, just speaking from the point of view of just the question, that the raising of this question is what differentiates the humans from the animals. So if the deer is running away from the lion and trips and falls into a ditch and breaks its leg and the lions come to eat the deer doesn't ask why. Right? The deer has physiological processes for dealing with anxiety and pain and so forth. But the deer, as far as we know, never asks why. And particularly doesn't ask why me. In fact, usually when we ask why is there suffering, if there's a God, why is there suffering, what we're really asking usually is why am I suffering? That's really why we're asking. You know, if we say, you know, why are people suffering in Bhutan, or why are people suffering in Patagonia, or why, what we're really asking is, why am I suffering? I seem to be a nice person, as far as I can tell. I'm pretty good. And I just don't understand. My suffering seems out of proportion to my character. Yes, we have all asked this question, right? I seem to be a much better person than the amount of suffering that I get. And this must mean that either there's no God, or he's sleeping, or he's impotent. There's something wrong with God, and that's why I'm suffering. But this question is at the root of human life. And therefore, Prabhupada says, the human beings have religion and the animals don't. And the human beings have some kind of religion. Right? Even tribal people have some kind of religion. Something. Maybe they're worshiping a mountain, or maybe they're worshiping the local river. But they have some sense that there's a higher power who's responsible for things. And this idea of religion is to answer this question. In fact, these are the questions religion should be answering. Who am I? Where did I come from? You know, why is anything here? Why does anything exist? Is there a higher power? And why is there suffering? And how can I get out of this suffering? These are the questions that religion should be answering for human society. And just asking these questions, like Vidura is doing, is a very wonderful thing. Frankly, there are many human beings walking around on the planet today who barely ask these questions. And in fact, the asking of these questions is very much discouraged in modern society. Yes? If you go to the regular schools and you ask these questions, you'll be told to be quiet. Who am I? Who is God? What's the Creator? Why is there suffering? They'll just tell you to be quiet. They'll say, I'm sorry, we don't discuss those things. And even if you go to most religious institutions, I mean, we hate to say this, but it's a fact. If you go to most religious leaders in the world today and you say, you know, why is there suffering in the world? Why is there so much evil? Why am I suffering? They really can't give you any kind of a decent answer. And often they'll just tell you also to be quiet. You know, don't ask that question. It's just a mystery. But here we find very directly, Vidura is asking this question. And of course, Maitreya is going to directly answer it. And this is one of the answer to this question is perhaps one of the main items, philosophical items, that differentiates a satisfying real religion from a not satisfying religion, isn't it? I mean, if we want to think about what are the unique aspects that Krishna consciousness has to offer, I mean, there's so many religious systems that will tell you to be moral. There's other religions that preach against intoxication, correct? Most religions preach against illicit sex. Even there's religions that preach against meat eating and gambling. There's religions that tell you not to lie and cheat. Most religions will tell you there's a God. Even they may have some idea that God is a person. I mean, they can't tell you that God is playing his flute and dancing with Radharani. But some idea that God is a person, that he's the Father, as Prabhupada said, he's the Father. But if we really want to look at what's special in the Hare Krishna movement, I'd say the two things that are really special in the Hare Krishna movement are the specifics of how God is a person. The specifics of the spiritual world, the specifics of Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes, and a very detailed explanation of how the material energy works and why we're suffering. What's the process of suffering? What's the process of getting free from suffering? And this is given only in very vague terms, I see, by other philosophies. It's not very specifically delineated. So should we look at the solution or should we just stop there? Should we look at the solution? Or should we just leave the question hanging for the next chapter? No? Look at the solution. Okay. So the asking this question, the way it's being put in this purport, is it God's fault? Is it the jiva's fault? Prabhupada's asking both ways, right? He said, well, God is great. God is the Father. God is the benefactor. Why is he standing right there? He's standing right there and witnessing misfortune and suffering without apparent interference. And the other question is, why is the soul, who's great and powerful also, and who has the qualities of God, why is the soul, who's right in the presence of God, engaged in ignorance and misfortune? So let's look at it first from the platform of God. So what could God do? Okay, God's right there in our heart. He's just sitting right there. What could he do so that we had no misfortune and we had no suffering? What could he do? What could God do? God could surrender? God could surrender to Krishna? That would be a little strange. No, what could God do? Not what could we do. You're answering the second question. You have to wait a minute. That's another 5 minutes. We can talk about that. Right now is what could God do? What could God do? So this is from the point of view of the Father. So the Father is standing right there, and the Son is suffering. What could the Father do? What could God do? He could just cure all the problems. How would he do that? He could influence. How could he? What would be his means of doing that? Through instructions, okay, so God could do that through instructions. He could give instructions, and what would the instructions be? What kind of instructions could God give? Do this and don't do this. Okay, if you do this, it works out well, and if you do this, it works out badly. He could let us know, just like you have a sign on your board. Don't park at a certain place, or you'll aggravate the neighbors and you may involve police action. Correct? You have a sign like that on your board? It's informing. So I remember once being at a temple where some of the guests were parked improperly. And one devotee I was with went up to the temple authorities and said, I think you should make an announcement that people are parked improperly and they're going to get towed. And the temple authorities said, you know, they can read the signs. So what one thing God could do is he could give instruction. And he could give instruction frequently, right? He could give instruction frequently. Do this, don't do this, don't do that. Okay, what else could God do to avoid the misfortune and the suffering of a living entity? So he could just wipe out the misfortune. Okay, so how exactly would that work? Would that mean you do the wrong thing but he wipes out the consequence? So, see, with the instruction, the implication is the consequences are still there, but you're given good guidance. But if you're talking about mystic power, so how exactly would he use his mystic power? What do we suggest?
He will put us in a right way.
What does the right way mean?
Not to suffer by us.
Well, give me some more details. What exactly? Huh?
Feed the hungry.
He would feed the hungry. So he would supply the means for getting rid of the difficulty.
Yeah. That means he fulfilled our desire.
Well, let's get one thing at a time. So first thing, he fulfilled the means. So if you were poor, he would send you money, and if you were hungry, he would send you food. Okay. Would that go along with the instructions of what to do with it? What, I mean, would he put the food in your mouth, or what would he do here? Now help me out a little bit here. What would he do? So he would just give you the means in front of you to do the right thing? And instructions how to use it. Okay, so he'd give you good instructions. We got that. He'd give you good instructions. And then he'd also give you all facility for getting the right thing. You said he'd fulfill your desires. That's a little dangerous one. That's a little dangerous one. That, because when you say that, what's the assumption?
You can have whatever you want.
Yeah, you can have whatever you want. That's what it means, fulfilling all desires, you can have whatever you want. But if you say, the way that we'd be free from all suffering and misfortune is to have all of our desires fulfilled, what is that state, what is that implying? What's the premise that leads to that conclusion?
I am the enjoyer.
I am the enjoyer, okay. What else? So, if all of my desires are fulfilled, then I would be happy. What's the other if that we're not saying there? Our desires are such that would lead us to happiness. That we desire things that will bring us happiness. See, nobody thought, figured that, because we all think, well, duh, of course I only desire things that will bring me happiness. Yes? That we just think that's so obvious that we don't even say that. Well, everything I desire are things that would bring me happiness. I don't have any desires that would bring me distress. I don't have any wrong desires. That's what we think. So therefore we think, if Krishna fulfilled all my desires, then I would be happy. And we don't necessarily ask, maybe I don't know what to desire. Maybe I'm desiring things that wouldn't bring me happiness. So maybe if he fulfilled all my desires, it wouldn't lead to happiness. But okay, he could fulfill all my desires. He'd give me good instruction. He could give me all the means of alleviating my distress. And he could fulfill all my desires. What else could he do? Okay, so he could not only give us good instruction, he could make it clear to us which of our desires were good and which of our desires were bad. He could show the real nature of our desires. Srila Prabhupada calls that seeing the naked form of material desires. We could see our desires for what they are. We could see, oh, this is a good desire, this is a bad desire. What else could God do to eliminate all suffering and misfortune? What else could he do? He could override our free will. This is the only thing that anybody's saying that actually God is incapable of doing. All the other things he's capable of doing, but that he's incapable of doing. Why is God incapable of overriding our free will?
It's inherent.
It's inherent. And why is it inherent? It's funny that I can't find it anymore, but it was a really nice lecture where Srila Prabhupada was explaining why Krishna is unable to override our free will. Okay, who are we? It's just said here in this purport. We are qualitatively one with the Lord. That means we are what? We are part of him, yes? Mamai vamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. If he overrides our free will, what is he doing? He's overriding the free will of a part of his own self. Is that even logical and sensible? No, it doesn't even make any sense. It's an illogical thing. It's like, can you be what you're not? It's you know, like someone asked Prabhupada, can God make a rock so heavy that he can't lift? He said, yes, he can make it a rock so heavy he can't lift, and then he can expand his potencies and lift it. But if Krishna overrode our free will, he'd be overriding the free will of a part of himself. Now, of course, Krishna can put us in a situation where we cannot exhibit our free will practically at all. He can do that. In what sort of circumstances can we, practically speaking, exhibit no free will? In the womb, of course, we can pray.
As a tree,
yeah. Or like as an amoeba or something like that. So he's perfectly capable of doing that. And, of course, he does do that also. Another time when we really don't exhibit any free will is When Mahavishnu breathes in, we go into the body of Mahavishnu and we remain kind of under anesthesia. Can you exhibit any free will when you're under anesthesia? Any of you have had surgery? No. So when we're in the body of Mahavishnu, then we cannot exhibit any free will at all. Does that mean it's gone? Is your free will gone when you're under anesthesia? No, it's just temporarily your consciousness is not manifest. So he could do that. He could do that. So Krishna could take the rebellious souls and put them in a permanent state of anesthesia. Forever. And ever. And ever. And ever. And some people want that. There are, you know, some religionists want that. They're saying that we want to stop existing. Yes? Other people who say that? We want to stop having a self. We want to stop having any consciousness at all. This is sunyavadi. Nirvisesha sunyavadi. They want to go into the void. All right, anything else that God could do? He could give us good instruction. He could give us all the resources that we need. He could fulfill all of our desires. He could illuminate which of our desires are good and which of our desires are bad. What else could he do? Yes?
He could give us love for him.
He could give us love. Can you give somebody love for you? You're the only one bringing up things that are impossible. Can you? You're a good person to have in the class. Can you give somebody love for you? Not really. I mean, we sometimes talk about that you know, Krishna awakens the love within the living entity and the devotee awakens the love within the living entity. But loving someone is also an act, it's something that comes from yourself. Right? You could put someone in a situation where they had reasons to love you, yes? You could put them around other people who love you. You could surround them with other people who love you. You could flood them with your love for them. I mean, I don't know about all of you, but I've been around people who just don't like me. And they just don't like me. I mean, I don't know why I'm so wonderful, but I mean, some people just don't like me. And it doesn't seem to matter how much I like them and how much they meet other people who like me and how many reasons I give to like me. They just simply stubbornly don't like me. I don't know why. Do we all have this experience? And do we have all of, I mean, I have had people in my life that I really, really, really wanted to like me. And I put out a tremendous amount of effort and energy to get them to like me. I don't do this so much anymore, but I especially did this with someone when I was a teenager. And it didn't work. It just didn't work. You know, the person finally said to me, look, I really just don't love you. I'm sorry. You know, so it's also like that God actually cannot, because then it's not love. Then it's not love. I mean, Prabhupada said, what's the difference between love and rape? You know, it's not love. Like Ravana who goes to Sita and says, you know, you need to love me, and if you don't love me, then I'm going to kill you, and my cooks will cut you up into little pieces, and I'll eat you for breakfast. So love me. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And you might say, well, Krishna is so wonderful if he exhibited everything before us. So that's another thing God could do. What else could God do? Yes?
Could release the influence that Maya has on us.
Okay, he could do that. And Prabhupada talks about that in his prayer. He said the living entities have come under illusion by your will. By your will you can release them by illusion, from illusion. Okay, what else could he do? As far as getting us to love him, what could he do to get us to love him?
He can take us back to Godhead.
He can just take us there. Okay. Yes? He could give us association of other people who love him. Okay, he could do that. What else could he do?
You didn't kill him.
He could give people prasadam. Okay. Any other things God could do? He could reveal himself. Maybe we'd love him if he showed himself. Sometimes we think like that. The reason I don't love him is I haven't met him. If I met him, I would love him. Okay, by the way, everybody, he does all of those things. Every single thing that we listed, he does, and he does quite actively. So Krishna in the heart is giving knowledge. And he is showing what's right and wrong. He's doing it in the heart. He's doing it through the scriptures. He's doing it through the religious and spiritual teachers of the world. He is fulfilling all of our desires. Nitya nityanam, chaitanya chaitanam, eko bahunam bo yo vidadati kaman. He does reveal what desires are good and what desires are bad, again from the heart and in the scriptures. He does show himself. He says, I am the light of the sun, I am the light of the moon. I am the air of life, I am the digestive fire, I am the flower-bearing spring. All beautiful, glorious, wondrous creations. He's showing himself all the time. Many times when people would say to Prabhupada, have you seen God? He said, everybody sees God. Don't you see the sunlight? He says, I'm the light in all luminous objects. That means the light in the light bulbs, the light coming from your phones. He says, I'm ability. So he is revealing himself. And of course, he's revealing himself in the deity in so many ways. You could say he could take us to the spiritual world, but that's where we happen to be right at this very moment. If there's Krishna, there's Radha. You have a sign like that out on your post. I was reading everything on the bulletin board this morning. So this is also the spiritual world. We're actually in the spiritual world. So he's doing all of those things. The only thing he isn't doing is removing our free will, which is not, it doesn't even make sense. We wouldn't be alive also if we had no free will. Right? Like this cup has no free will. It can't say, don't pick me up, stop that, put me down. You know, it doesn't have any free will. Free will is the ability to say, what?
Stop.
No. Our machines don't have that ability. Your little phones, your little computer, you know, when you say start, run, it can't say, no, I don't feel like it this way. So if we didn't have any free will, also we wouldn't be alive. To say someone is alive and they have no free will. And the other thing is, would we really want that? Would anybody really want that? Would we like that? No. If we had some way, you know, we could hook your brain up to electrodes and just force you to do things against your will. Or even if we arranged, we said, okay, everybody, we'll arrange for someone to come into your house with a gun and follow you around. Even to do what you say you want to do. You could make a list. These are the things I really want to do that I'm struggling with. Okay, fine, we'll send someone to your house with a gun. They'll follow you around and force you to do the things that you say you want to do. Would anybody like that? You know, or we'll put electrodes in your brain to stimulate the brain centers associated with love. I don't think anybody would like that. So that God's not going to do, but everything else he's actually already doing. He's doing all of those things. And he's doing them all the time. Okay, now what could we do? Because here Prabhupada's saying, it looks like maybe the problem is God, or it looks like maybe the problem is the jiva. Right? So we can say, well, it doesn't seem to me that God is doing that. I'm not experiencing that God is doing that. I don't know what to do. I don't know what desires are good and what desires are bad. I'm not perceiving him in the world. So to say he's doing that is only theoretical to me. It seems like he isn't doing it. He should do it more obviously. So then we come to, well, what am I doing? So what could the jiva do? Yes?
Inquiring from the spiritual master solicitly and serving.
Well, there you go. So the jiva could ask, and this is what's happening in this verse, asking. And to do, asking submissively. Asking with wanting to know the answer. By the way, generally when we ask, we don't want to know the answer. Did you know that? We don't really want to know the answer. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, what's being explained here, that God is sitting or standing, right next to me. And he's doing all of those things. He's showing what's good and what's bad. He's giving all facility for all happiness. He's providing all facility. Yoga Kshema Bahamyaha. and he's revealing himself, and yet I don't seem to be aware of that, or I'm aware of it only slightly, occasionally. So what must I be doing? I must be rebelling. What does somebody do when they're rebelling? Have you ever talked to somebody who was rebellious?
They ignore you.
And they may even literally, physically turn their face away from you. Have you had this experience? That you're trying to give good instruction to someone and they don't look at you? And they're physically looking someplace else? We call this bahir muke. They've turned their face. Right? So this is what we're doing. Oh, you could also ask, just stepping back for a minute, how do we know that God's doing all those things? Maybe he really isn't. Maybe I am really looking at him, and maybe I do really want to know, and maybe he's just not doing all of those things. That would imply that God is what kind of a person? Well, I don't think logically God could be impersonal. I don't think impersonalism is a logical argument based on ordinary sense perception. Just like could this book stand have been created by an imperson? Could it have been created by just some impersonal force? Right? Or the designs up there, could they have been created by an impersonal force? Or could they have been just not created at all, just sort of, they just are. So that's not logical. To say that there's no creator and there's no maintainer, or that the creator and maintainer is impersonal, is completely out of sync with all of our experience. There's no relation to our experience. I mean, even to look at that mat there, which is an extremely simple thing, much simpler than this book stand. So the mats that all of you are sitting on are extremely simple. But could they have been made just, could they have just kind of showed up randomly? Just the floor just sort of manifests mats. No, could they have been created by some impersonal force? Do impersonal forces create mats? No. Could they even have been created by a one-year-old or a chimpanzee? I mean, they had to have been created by an intelligent person. So, and things have to be maintained. There's something that's maintaining everything. Something's maintaining the water cycle and the orbits of the planet. It's not just there was a creator who walked away. So just from logic and reason and experience, there must be a God and that God must be a person. That's just logic and reason. But if God isn't doing any of those things, if he isn't giving us intelligence, if he isn't giving us guidance, if he isn't illuminating our desires, if he isn't providing all the means for happiness, then what kind of a person would he have to be? A mean person. He'd have to be cruel. And in fact, there are religions which suggest that there's God and a devil. And that God's somewhere else having a good time listening to harp music. While the devil's in charge of the world. And God's kind of sad about it, but he doesn't really get very involved. And he just lets the devil create havoc. So there are definitely philosophies like this. That the supreme power in the world is evil. And that the power for good is, for whatever reasons, inscrutable reasons, is just in some detached place. And maybe he'll interfere later. Whereas, you know, I'm suffering today. But somehow that'll all be worked out in some future time. Do we have any logical, reasonable evidence that God is beneficent rather than malevolent? Do we have any empiric evidence that would suggest that God is a good benefactor?
I might have to ask a question here.
In
the Crowded Karma of the Sanjayas, Raniyadi Beatty, it says that all the meanness, our mean qualities are emanating from. Could you expand on that to help me to understand how Krishna is the source of all these things and yet he's not mean?
Okay, so you're going to you're saying that we have our evidence that God may be mean is that there's meanness in the world and everything has to come from him. Okay, so that's a logical argument as to why God might be mean. because we have meanness and we have evil and everything's coming from God, so therefore meanness and evil must be in him too. Okay? Any other logical, reasonable arguments about God's nature, if he's good or bad? Because maybe I lied to you. Maybe he's not doing all those things. Maybe he's not giving us intelligence. Maybe he's not giving us resources. Maybe he's not fulfilling our desires. Maybe the problem is really with him. Now, if the problem's really with him, we're in a very bad situation. I mean, we're really in trouble. Because if the problem is with God, then I've got no options anywhere, do I? I'm a mess. And life is a mess. I mean, if the supreme ultimate power is evil, there's no solution, is there? Is there any solution? There's no solution. I mean, even death wouldn't do it, you know. If you jumped off a building, you'll just go in eternal hell. You'll just watch while you suffer. You didn't believe in me, you suffer. It would mean that ultimate reality is just painful and miserable. Okay, you could give that as a proof, but that proof is predicated on the idea that we've rebelled. So we're saying, let's back up a minute and say, suppose we haven't rebelled. Suppose the problem is just him. Suppose I really am open and I really am willing and I really am submissive and I really am surrendered. And the problem really is God. That's Vidura's question in this verse. So you can't really answer that doubt by presuming that we've rebelled. Do you follow? You can't make that as the assumption. Do we have any logical, empirical evidence that ultimate reality is good and not evil? Yes. Yes, so that's certainly some empirical evidence. That nature supplies very abundantly. And in general, nature supplies more than what's needed. So someone who's evil does not give more than what's needed. They tend to give less than what's needed. You know, if we think about evil regimes that employed slave labor, they'd give their slaves just barely enough to live, right? And they'd work them till they died, and then they'd get more slaves. Correct? Yes? What about flowers? Anybody need flowers? Are flowers necessary? Could plants pollinate and reproduce without fragrant, beautiful flowers? They could. There are plants that don't have fragrant, beautiful flowers and they reproduce. So just for life to go on, fragrant, beautiful flowers are not needed. So things like that, elements of beauty that are not needed, are some evidence of caring. There's some evidence of goodness. Beauty in and of itself is some evidence of goodness. Just like even in this room, there's all sorts of things that are beautiful that go beyond function. Yes? Correct? Much of the beauty in this room is not absolutely necessary for function. And the fact that there's beauty that goes beyond function is evidence that whoever designed this room had some goodness in them. So that there's far more beauty and variety and taste beyond mere function is some empiric evidence that God is good. If God was simply evil, they would only be suffering. Why would he provide any good at all? Why would there be any kind of pleasure in anything? So we have this mixed pleasure. Well, why would there be pleasure? Why would it exist? And I'd say even beyond that, why would we have the desire for unlimited, boundless pleasure? I mean, unless God was so evil that he wanted to torture us all with an unfulfillable desire. But where do we have this desire from? Where does it come from if there wasn't any such thing? Yeah, but if it comes from Krishna, then that means that Krishna must have goodness in him. It's something like fish don't have any desire to drink water. Do they have any desire to drink water? Fish? Do they feel thirst? Can fish feel thirst? No, because it's not their nature. It's not part of their nature. So the fact that we feel thirst means it's part of our nature. The fact that we have a desire for unlimited happiness Yes, we all have that desire. The advertisers capitalize on that. Buy this toothpaste, you'll get unlimited happiness. You know. Right? Buy this laundry soap and you'll have a happy family forever. But where does this desire come from? If the absolute nature is evil and cruel and mean and full of suffering, if that was reality, we wouldn't have a desire for anything else. And you're saying we see evil in ourselves, but we see good in ourselves too. So maybe God is complex. Because if you're going to make the argument that where does evil come from? Where does anger and envy and lust and greed come from? That must come from God. But also our feelings of love and affection and altruism and sacrifice must come from God. So I think our conclusion is that God is very complex. That you can't reduce God to some sort of simple formula. Which you can't. Can you reduce God to some simple formula? I mean, he's pretty heavy duty as the universal form, eating all the soldiers. So we say that God has those, that Krishna has those things in him also. Krishna has some form of anger and Krishna has some form of lust. Like Prabhupada would say, Krishna with the gopis, has no lust. And then sometimes he would say, but if he does, he has unlimited lust. No, so all these things must exist in some form in God. So we'd have to say that he's complex. But overall, the desire of living beings is not for evil. At least certainly not for themselves. All living entities desire at least good for themselves, yes? Anybody desire evil for themselves? Does anyone say, I desire failure and misfortune for myself? Maybe you desire failure and misfortune for everybody else. But certainly not for ourselves. Yeah, but even masochists are trying to enjoy in that way. They're thinking, you know, if I cut my arm, it'll bring me happiness. It's kind of weird. You know. But they're still looking for their happiness and they're looking for their fortune. So that must be the ultimate mentality of God, although he's definitely complex and not easily understood. Just, you know, he's not just good in some I'm good kind of way. Clearly, he can't be that good in that sense. But ultimately, we see everybody wants good, therefore Krishna wants good. So that's backing up a little bit. That's our main evidence that God is doing all of those things. And that the problem, therefore, is with me. Now, if the problem's with me, the difficulty is that I don't see that the problem is with me. Just like I don't perceive all the good that God is doing. It doesn't seem to be that way. I don't hear his instructions. I don't see his wonderful form. It's as if it's not there, nor do I see my rebellion. So, of course, this is very nicely explained in the Bhagavad Gita according to the modes of nature, which, as I was saying, some of the unique contributions of our Krishna conscious philosophy is understanding the nature of God, the person, who is very complex and has unlimited qualities, and how material nature works. So how material nature works, there's three modes, and then there is transcendence to the modes. So if one is in the mode of ignorance, one does not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. One does not know what is binding and what is liberating. One cannot see oneself, one cannot see others, one cannot see God. And all of one's actions will result in being bound and being foolish and suffering, and there'll be no happiness at all. It's kind of like being covered with a black cloth that you can't see through. You know, even if you go to some of these Muslim countries, some of these women are walking around with what looks like just big black garbage bags over their head. You know. Actually, this is a real side point, but just one of the funniest things I ever saw was in Bahrain, where there were these two ladies just walking down the street with these big black bags over them, and there was this man oogling them. You know what I mean? He was like trying to undress them with his eyes. And I thought, buddy, you're just simply in a fantasy world. I mean, you couldn't tell anything about those. You couldn't tell how old they were, how fat they were, anything. You know, there's just two black bags walking down the street. But he's looking at them like, I wonder if they're enjoyable. It was very, very pathetic. So the mode of ignorance is like this big black bag, right? Of course, those ladies, they have a little screen over their eyes, right? Otherwise, they would trip over the sidewalk. But in the mode of ignorance, you don't even have the little screen. You know, you just have a black bag with no screen. And so you keep tripping over the sidewalk. Right? You don't know where you're going. You walk into walls and all kinds of things. You can't see. Then the mode of passion is more, it's like the kind of windows they have in a bathroom. You know, so you can see a little bit. You can sort of see what's to be done and what's not to be done. You have some sense of what's religion, a little bit. Right? So sometimes you get it right. And if you're really strongly in the mode of passion, you get to be an enjoyer of the world. Prabhupada says someone who dies in the mode, purely in the mode of passion will become a king or a very rich person. Now, if you're in the mode of goodness, it's like having glass around you, transparent glass. And you can see. You're still bound, right? If you're inside of a glass building, you're still in the building. You're not free. But at least if it's glass, then you can see, as Krishna says, what's binding, what's liberating, what to be done, what not to be done. Then you can see your desires clearly. You can see things clearly. And you're much more likely to make the right choices. And then, of course, if you're mamchayovyavicharana bhakti yogina sevate sagunan samatitchaitam prabhubhuyaya kalpate, if you're out of any kind of covering, if you're out in the open sunlight, then it says that one's duties become self-illuminated by the grace of the Lord. Then everything is clear. What to do, what not to do, which of my desires are right, which of my desires are not right, and I get everything, like you're saying, you get food, you get money, yoga, kshema, vaham, yaham. Everything that you need is just provided. And in fact, as devotees, don't we experience this? As we start coming out of the modes and we start coming into transcendence, we can start seeing things more clearly? Yes, do we experience this? Oh, that's why they're doing that. Oh, that's why I'm doing that. Oh, that's what leads to that. Oh, that's what leads to that. And do you start getting what you need for your service? Does that start happening? You need something and it shows up? Sometimes at the last minute, but Krishna likes to play hero sometimes and do things at the last minute. Yeah, so all those things start manifesting when you come to Sattva-guna, what to speak of when you come out of any covering. So what determines who's in tamaguna, who's in rajaguna, who's in sattvaguna, who's out of the gunas? What determines that? We do. We have certain desires that can only be fulfilled in tamaguna. And we have certain desires that can only be fulfilled in rajaguna, in certain society, depending on what we want. So if I have very base desires, the only way I can fulfill those desires is to be covered as true reality, is to not see the effect of my desires. If we insist, I insist, I insist, I insist. You could say, well, why does Krishna fulfill the desires that require a covering of tamaguna, which then leaves a person only to suffering? Because if he didn't fulfill all desires, there would be no free will. I can't act on my free will independently. I don't have the capacity. Does that make sense to everybody? I don't, as a little soul, I don't have the ability. So in order for me to have free will, in order for me to be fully alive, Krishna has to facilitate all my desires, and some of my desires necessitate being covered. There's just no way to fulfill those desires in knowledge. You just can't. If a person really could understand what smoking was doing to them, could they smoke? They wouldn't be able to. You know, for most people, could they eat meat if they were seeing what happened in the slaughterhouse? You know, even in the slaughterhouse, they only allow a few people to actually kill the animals because it's so traumatic. Most people, if they saw what was happening, if they were really faced with it, they couldn't do it. So they want to do it. It's okay. Don't see. Does that make sense to everybody? If you say, I want to do this. I want to do it. I want to do it. It's bad for you. It's bad for you. But I really want to do it. Well, all right. If you really want to do it, you're not going to be able to see what you're doing. You're not going to understand what you're doing. You're not going to understand the nature of your desire. You're not going to understand the nature of your consequence. That's okay. I want it. Of course, the problem is that once you get covered like that and you can't see anything anymore and you can't tell what you're doing, it's hard to start making right choices, isn't it? And very difficult to start making right choices. So therefore, of course, the devotees of the Lord are very merciful, and they give people opportunities. They kind of move the coverings away a little bit. Right? We go out on Harinam, we go out on book distribution, we go out on prasadam distribution. And what those things do is they move the coverings. Because there's our free will there too, right? So if the jiva is saying, I want to be in ignorance, I want to be in ignorance, and the devotee is saying, Krishna, please let this person out of ignorance. So we have our free will. So Krishna says, all right, by your desire, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains this nicely in Madhurya Kadambini, by your desire, my dear devotee, I will give this jiva an opportunity even when they're not asking for. And Krishna will take this thick black covering that's over them, or this little thinner covering, and he'll move it a little by our desire. And then the jiva may become attracted, or not. The jiva may go, ooh, what's that? Wow, what is that taste? What is in that book? What is in that music? Or the jiva may go, ugh, light, take it away, take it away. Yes? Do sometimes people do that? You go to wake them up in the morning, and you open up the curtains, and they go, close them, close them. Turn off the light. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, Prabhu. Turn off the light, I said, close the curtains. So the jiva has that ability also. Right? This is why Rupa Goswami says the one qualification to start bhakti, vaidhi sadhana bhakti, is a taste. It's some desire, some attraction. So the devotee, by the devotee's desire, Krishna parts the curtains a little bit, and if the jiva responds with some attraction, then that's the qualification to begin. And then as the jiva responds with some attraction, but that's free will. Just like even if God comes in front of you, you know, I'd love him if he came in front of me, but Kaliya didn't fall in love with Krishna when Krishna fell in front of him. He said, oh, what a beautiful, beautiful person. Let me kill him. And Kaliyavana did the same thing. He saw the Lord and he said, oh, that's who Narada was describing. That's God. Wow, he is amazing. Let me kill him. So, you know, it's not necessarily that just because you come in front of God and even he displays everything, or Duryodhan, Krishna displayed the universal form to Duryodhan. And Duryodhan said, capture him. He didn't say, oh, I surrender. He said, capture him. So, this process of bhakti has one goal and one goal only, according to Bhagavad Gita 12.9, and that is to increase our desire. Everything we're doing, all of our japa, all of our kirtan, all of our puja, all of our association with devotees, all of our reading the scripture, is to get our desire up and up and up and up and up and up and up until we no longer care about all of our material attachments. We're willing to see the naked form of them. We're willing to actually see Krishna as he is. We're willing to allow ourselves to become attracted to Krishna. We're willing to see the naked form of our desires, even though that's a very embarrassing thing to see. Right? That suggestion that we could see our desires clearly and see where they're headed to, that's a little embarrassing. When you see your desires, what they're, oh, wow, I have a desire that's only bringing pain and suffering to myself. Oh. So that's a little difficult. So to have the desire to see that, to have the desire to turn our face to Krishna. And no matter what stage you are in bhakti, whether it's the very, very first stage, everything is being propelled by that desire. We are meant to increase and increase and increase and increase that desire. So why, the answer to this question, why is the living entity suffering and misfortune, even though God is standing right next to the living entity, and even though the living entity is the nature of God? The answer is desire of the living entity. That is the answer. So, questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Could answer.
No, go ahead.
Could the reason why all virtues and vices emanate from Krishna and to give us absolute freedom of independence, so that we can, you know, if it was only good that we could come away from Krishna and do it, we would be there.
That's very well put. Of course, there isn't any intrinsic evil. Evil does not exist intrinsically. What we call evil is a misuse of something good. It's just like these cartels are neutral. They're not good or evil. But if I hit you over the head with them, that's evil. But there's no evilness intrinsically in either my hand or the cartels. So there isn't evil. Prabhupada would sometimes say evil is Krishna's backside. But Krishna's back isn't evil either. Krishna has a lovely back. So it's not that, you know, Krishna's back is all full of sores and boils or something like that. It's not what it means. There isn't any such thing in and of itself as evil. It just isn't. It's simply a misuse of something good. It's simply taking something that's good and using it with myself at the center. But you could say the concept of doing things with myself at the center must also come from Krishna. Well, yes, it comes from Krishna, because Krishna is at the center. So, yes.
How to understand the God in a simple way and a simple sentence?
A simple sentence. How would you understand God in a simple sentence? When Prabhupada was asked what was the one verse of the Bhagavatam, he took a verse from the first canto that everything should be used for Krishna's service and not for sense gratification. Or you could take the four sentences, the Chaturshloki from the Bhagavatam, and the ninth chapter of the second canto. You could take the four nutshell verses. That still doesn't get you down to one sentence, gets you down to four sentences. But you could get the four sentences from the 10th chapter, 8, 9, 10, and 11, if you want to understand God in a really simple way. Oh, there's one sentence. Akhila Rasamrita Murti. There you can go. That's a nice, simple, one-sentence definition of God that Rupa Goswami gives. Akhila Rasamrita Murti. He is the form of all rasas, which include, by the way, anger and ghastliness and fear. That's Rupa Goswami's one-sentence definition of God. Yes, Rupa.
This question is commonly asked by everybody.
Yes.
And very often is the cause of disbelief in God.
It is the cause of disbelief in God.
Especially in this age, because they can't see beyond that point without assistance. And even then,
it's very difficult.
Yeah.
This is a big point of lack of faith among religious people, among devotees in the Hare Krishna movement in 2015. I mean, this is the point, which is why we can't possibly delve into it in full depth and satisfaction in one class or even two classes. But this is the point. This is the only logical, rational argument for atheism. And it is the cause of all of our doubts and all of our unwillingness to surrender and all of our difficulty. Right there in this particular question. If there's a God and he's all good and I'm a soul and I'm all good, why in the world am I suffering? And why do my actions lead to misfortune? Why do I do things that I think will bring me good fortune and instead they bring me misfortune? It is the question. And it is, you know, this ties into the did we fall from the spiritual world, which is the main philosophical doubt that ties into the same thing. You know, if I'm all good and God's all good, why would I choose to have started this? Why am I choosing to do it now? I mean, I just had an email interchange that went on for weeks with one new devotee who's just kept insisting that all of his difficulty was God's fault. You know, no matter how I answered, he just kept insisting. You know, well, if only God would give me a job where I didn't have to be with materialistic people. If only God would put me on a higher planet. You know, why does he have to put me on the Earth planet in Kali Yuga? Did you have a question?
My husband, kind of.
He already.
Yeah.
You're in sync, huh? Yes, Prabhu.
Yeah.
Okay. So If it's true that all of our misfortune, all of our suffering is due to our turning away from God, then why do people who haven't turned away from God, why do they have any misfortune and any suffering? And why do they seem to make decisions that don't turn out right, even? If they're getting all intelligence and knowledge from God, why did Prabhupada start the center in Jhansi? Didn't work out. Why did he go down the alley where he got gored by a bull or a cow? Why didn't Krishna tell him, go down the other alley? Why did he buy the property in Juhu? Prabhupada actually said, if Krishna had told me the man was a cheater, I wouldn't have bought it. Why did Maharaj Yudhisthira gamble? You know, why did Bhishma join the side of the Kurus? Why is there suffering for the great devotees? You know, that's really discouraging. Because you think, okay, all this is true. So if I just turn to Krishna and I just look at Krishna, I just surrender to Krishna, then I won't have any misfortune or any suffering in my life. Right? Okay, I accept that theoretically. But wait a minute, okay. I see the other devotees in the Hare Krishna movement and that one looks pretty surrendered. I mean, that devotee looks really, and everyone else says that devotee surrendered. All the other devotees say, hey, you want to find someone who surrendered? Look at that one. So I look at that one and I see, you know, they get cancer. Their kid doesn't turn out good. Right? Their husband leaves them. They lose all their money. People criticize them. And I say, well, that doesn't seem to work either. One of my relatives made that point. She said, what's the use of being religious? Religious people suffer just like everybody else. Why even bother? Okay, so again, then you're going to a view of ultimate reality, which is no exit. You're saying life is suffering, whatever you do, it's suffering, and God doesn't help, and in fact, even makes his devotees suffer. God is evil, or he's just sort of whimsical or something like that, childish. Where are you going to go with that kind of philosophy? Just let's take it that that's a fact. Where are you going to go? You can't even commit suicide. What are you going to do? I mean, it's just awful. You're then like in some kind of a trap with no exit. Yes? Okay. So how would we explain this? So I would suggest the only way ultimately to understand this is pratyaksha. Rajavidya rajaguyam pavitram idamuchamam pratyaksha vagamam dharmam susukam kartam. To have some practical experience that things that look like suffering and misfortune externally, when you're in the proper consciousness, are not experienced as suffering and misfortune. Because if I just say to you, Srila Prabhupada did not experience his suffering and misfortune as suffering and misfortune, and neither did the pandits. If I just say that to you, you might say, well, sounds good. But one has to actually experience that. Now, we all have a little bit of experience of that, even on a gross material level. Okay, if I really love somebody, if I'm very attached to someone, and I do something for them that involves some trouble on my part, do I experience that as trouble? If you have a really good friend and you want to plan a birthday party for them, and you've saved up some money, and you use that money to buy gifts for them, and you use, instead of for yourself, and you use your day that you could have used sitting around doing what you wanted to do, playing computer games or whatever, and you use that to plan their party and invite the guests, that's all trouble, but you experience it as trouble. If there's actual affection for the other person, you do not experience it as trouble. In fact, you experience it as pleasure. Has everyone had this experience? That trouble undertaken out of affection for somebody else is experienced as happiness. In fact, we even have some sense of pride and satisfaction in the trouble we take for those that we love. Correct? You know, people feel pride in sacrificing for their country, for their employer. And that's completely material. That's completely material. There's still even selfishness wrapped up in that. But if you get a little bit selfless, trouble somehow vanishes. And you can't even distinguish between the sacrifice and the enjoyment. The sacrifice of preparing for the party and the enjoyment of going to the party are one in enjoyment. And this is explained in Bhagavad Gita 4:24. that the person offering, what they're offering, the consummation, the offering, it all becomes merged into transcendence. So the time when sacrifice feels like sacrifice is when you're in the modes of passion or ignorance. When you're thinking about yourself, then the enjoyment is enjoyment and the sacrifice is sacrifice. And as soon as you get even to sattva-gun, the sacrifice starts becoming also pleasurable. So that's one answer, that those who are merged in love for God, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I see my troubles undertaken as my great happiness. So if we can feel like that, if we love a dog, I mean, people undergo sacrifice for their dog, yes, and take it as pleasure, correct? So if we can feel that, but they do, yes, they do. You know, you're taking your dog out for a walk every day and standing there while they poo and picking up the poo and throwing it into the garbage. But people are finding pleasure in that because there's more pleasure in giving than there is in being selfish. There just is, even if you're giving to a dog or you're giving to your child or your mother or your country. So imagine if the recipient of your sacrifice was God, who's the source of all jivas. So if we can feel happiness in sacrificing for one little jiva, who may not even reciprocate very well, how much happiness could I feel in sacrificing for God? That would be a joy. So the trouble and the difficulty the devotees feel in sacrificing for God, that's a joy. Now another answer is that they're not identifying with their body. And when you're not identifying with your body and you're not attached to your body, you do not feel the pains and pleasures of the body. Something like if you drive past a car accident and the person in the accident is a stranger to you, you don't feel any pain. But if the person in the accident was your brother or your mother, you would feel pain. The pain is due to attachment. The pain is not due to the circumstances. And I'm not going to, but we could teach everybody here in a half an hour how to do hypnosis. And under hypnosis, you could be in a state where you don't feel any pain. Prabhupada explains this in teachings of Lord Kapila. And I've done it myself. So you can put yourself in a detached state where on a physical, technical level, the body is in pain. Prabhupada says you can even be having a surgical operation and you do not feel any pain. You're simply there as the observer. So if any of us could do that, and anybody could do that, technically, mechanically, you can do that. It's something you can learn how to do. You can learn how to do it literally in half an hour. So what to speak of if you really realize that you're not the body, then you'd constantly be in that state of the observer. No, we don't want to be in that state of the observer. We want to be enjoying this body. So we know that's our problem. We don't want to be just a neutral observer of the world, which is actually what we are. So the great devotees, they're just neutral observers. And they're not feeling the pains and pleasures of the body as pains and pleasures. They're aware of them, but they're not feeling them as pains and pleasures. Like if you're in a car, you're aware that the petrol tank is down, but you don't feel hungry. It doesn't make you feel hungry. And then another answer is that not only are persons in that state enjoying sacrifice and not identifying with the body, but they're also in an adventure and in a story, and this relates to the fact that God is complex. So in the mode of goodness, you see everything clearly. What's to be done, what's not to be done, what's binding, what's liberating. And when you're higher than the mode of goodness, when you're in touch with Paramatma, you have this all-knowing, you're in touch with the all-knowingness. So you would never do something that didn't work out perfectly because you were always in the all-knowingness. But there's a kind of boring to being in the all-knowingness. And therefore, above the all-knowingness is something called Yogamaya. And Yogamaya is so much fun that Krishna likes to be in Yogamaya so that he doesn't know that the cowherd boys are going to go into Agasura's mouth and he doesn't know what he's going to do about it. He has to figure it out. He has to stand there and go, what do I do? Because that's fun. Okay? One of the biggest money makers on the planet are mysteries. Mystery movies, mystery books. And they in education you learn that if you really want to have full attention in a class, have a mystery that only gets solved at the end of the class. And you can have people paying attention to any stupid, irrelevant subject if you make it a mystery. We're innately curious beings who like to unfold things, and we don't want everything right in front of us. Try posting on the internet the endings of all the popular movies, somebody will come and kill you. Yes? So that's also for the devotees. And Krishna and the devotees like to be involved in these adventures and leelas where you don't know how things are going to work out, and sometimes things don't work out right the first time. Sometimes Krishna's in the coils of Kaliya for 2 hours, before he jumps out. And then he's dancing, and he doesn't immediately kill him. He's dancing. But it's exciting. If Krishna just went to Kali and said, poof, dead. You know, or Indra comes and Krishna says, okay, Indra, you know, you're fired. But there's this whole calamity. I mean, talk about doing something that didn't have an auspicious result immediately. You know, they worship Govardhan and there's floods. Why didn't Krishna tell them there'd be floods? Because then it's a story and there's floods and it's cold. Krishna, help. And then even then, Krishna doesn't just dry up the water or provide some big drain to Patalaloka or something like that. You know, he picks up a mountain, which, I mean, there's all these far-out stories. So the devotees enjoy being in the stories, and being in the stories means that apparently sometimes you make bad decisions and apparently things don't work out right away and there's some crisis and there's some calamity and Krishna has to come and be the hero and save you, and it's all this drama and all those things. And that's our personalistic view. So our personalistic view is the highest is not Brahman, the highest is not Paramatma, but the highest is Bhagavan, where there's adventure and where there's lila. And the devotees in that adventure and lila are experiencing all kinds of ecstasy, which may sometimes come as fear and anxiety and bewilderment and so forth. But again, the only way to really believe these things is to experience them. So just to accept this as a theoretical, philosophical construct may be okay for the first week or month or year or whatever, but at a certain point, pratyakshavagamam danyon susukam kartamavyam. So kind of jump in and go there and do the service, not that I've got to do my service, I've got to do my sacrifice, but with some love, maya shakti manaparta, with some affection for Guru, with some affection for Krishna, with some affection for the devotees, you know, really to work on this practical detachment. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Jivadharma talks about how we can see all of our life. I mean, this is actually Mahaprabhu's lila. We can see our life as lila. And then one does not experience misfortune and suffering, even though from a materialistic point of view, a materialist may look at you and say, well, you have misfortune and suffering in your life. You're like, huh? Where? But wait a minute, you lost all your money and those people are criticizing you. That's misfortune and suffering. It's wonderful. So that has to be practically experienced. And I think we have to end now, yes? Are we gone to time? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.